And those are very important crops worldwide for both commercial production as well as subsistence production for many families. So I'm looking at movement of the banana weevil. Its movement is nocturnal. It only crawls. It doesn't fly. And it's been shown to orient towards volatiles from its host plant in the lab at distances of up to 60 centimeters. It's also been found that the banana weevils will orient upwind towards volatiles under conditions of constant airflow in the lab.
What I want you to know, the bottom line here, is that BT, if you have it in the right host and you have the right complex of toxins, it does in fact invade the hemolymph, colonize tissues, and then sporulate very extensively in its host. Now, I don't disagree with what they said about the gypsy moth, although I have some doubts about the experiment. But the gypsy moth is what I would call an unnatural host for BT. From my experience, I work mainly with mosquitoes, but where you see most BTs, especially BTs that routinely cause epizootics, is in pyralid moths. And in those, the larva basically becomes a pure culture of BT. So, major flaws in this paper, lack of important concepts of pathogenesis, particularly specificity and virulence. That's true of all...
Adjudicate. So what I did is that I read some 13-star viburnum leaf beetle larvae in groups of one, I mean individually, groups of five and groups of 10, until pupation and adult emergence. I recorded the larval survivorship and the adult weight. And I repeated this experiment for three different viburnum hosts. Viburnum trilobum, which is a North American viburnum species that is very susceptible to viburnum leaf beetle, and on viburnum sieverdi and viburnum carlisi that are less susceptible to viburnum species. And usually larvae would do less well on these two less species, because we wanted to know if there's a benefit of larval group feeding, maybe it's only expressed on a less preferred host. And we did five replicates for each combination of host and larval density. That's good. So let me show you the results. First, in terms of survivorship. As you can see, when the larvae were reared in groups of 10, there was a very high survivorship of the larvae for all the species that were tested. When they were reared in groups of 5, we can see a noticeable decrease in the survivorship on Viburnum sieverdi and Viburnum carlisi, that are the two resistant species. And then they were reared individually, we can see a significant and pretty dramatic decrease in survivorship, even on Viburnum trilobum, that was a susceptible Viburnum species. And the interesting thing is to notice that these three lines are almost parallel, which means that the effect of larval density on survivorship of the larvae was almost all species independent in this case. Another effect of larval density on adult weight, so we did a two-way ANOVA to analyze the results with the adult weight being the dependent variable. And so we found that both host species and larval density had a very significant effect on adult weight, but the interaction between these two factors was non-significant. And graphically, let me show you the results. So you can see in red the weight of the larvae of the adults coming from the larvae that were reared in groups of 5, and in yellow, the weight from the adults that coming from larvae that were reared in groups of 10. And you can see that the yellow, the adults coming from larvae reared in groups of 10 were always heavier than the other one, the one coming from larvae reared in groups of 5. So it was just for the adult weight, and the female weight, we see the same results, very consistent. And another, and again, it's very interesting to see that these two lines are again almost parallel. And so it means that, again, in this case, there was a clear effect of larval density on adult weight. There was also an effect of an overall effect of the species. So you can see that the species, when the larvae were reared on Viburnum carlisi and Viburnum sieverdi, the adults basically were lighter. But the interaction between the two was non-significant, which means that the effect of larval density was non-dependent on the host species on adult weight. So conclusion of this second experiment, larval survivorship was significantly decreased when the larvae were reared individually, even on the susceptible viburnum. There was a significant increase in adult weight with when larval density increased. These results were consistent for all the species tested, so it was not only on resistant labellum species, but on the three species tested. And as I said, the density effect was independent on host species. So, kind of as a summary and a discussion about these results, we can say now that there are at least two clear benefits of aggregative oviposition for labellum leaf beetle. First one is overcoming the plant defense, and the second one is larval group feeding. But there might be also some costs associated with aggregative oviposition. And as I said earlier, we can see that the twig mortality increases with the number of egg masses on a twig, which means potential increased larval competition. And another thing that is unclear after this experiment is that we see a pretty consistent benefit of larval group feeding, but we don't know the reason or the mechanism behind this benefit. So it might be that feeding facilitation, larvae feeding in groups will have easier time to feed and go through the leaves. But in our case, labellum leaf beetle larvae do not feed gregariously, so that you will find them in numerous, in high densities on a very restricted location, but they do not feed gregariously, they do not gather to feed. So maybe facilitation of feeding is not the case in our case, I mean, you know, for our species. It could be overcoming the plant defenses, or there might be also some behavioral change. Maybe the insect repartition their time differently if they are in groups or individually. And future works, as a follow-up of the first experiment, we will try to measure the egg overwintering success depending on degree of infestation. And as I said, try to do an observational study of the larval development depending on the larval density. Thank you, and I will take any questions.
In the field. So to answer these questions, I set up a randomized complete box design with a 2x2 factorial treatment structure. So the two factors are first the distance of release, either 1 or 2 meters from the center of one of these hexagonal arrays where I released the weevils, and then either the presence or absence of a piece of banana stem. So the hexagons there represent the arrays where I released the weevils. So the little dots represent weevils, and it's either 2 meters or 1 meters from the center where there's either a piece of banana or nothing. So I released 6 weevils in each of those 4 plots. There's also a 4-meter buffer around the edge of those to give the weevils space to move. And then each time I released them, I tracked them for 2 to 5 days afterwards. So each of those releases constitutes a separate block. And I did this in Costa Rica at Catie in Turrialba with weevils from their banana collections and also banana from their collections. You can see there is a piece of banana stem, and the hexagon around it shows where I released the weevils. And in order to track them, I used harmonic radar. This is a technique that has been used with several insects, particularly carabids. And it allows you to tag the weevil, release it, and then locate it again with the harmonic radar unit. So there's the unit. It's made by the Recco Corporation. And then the tag consists of a very small diode soldered to a very light wire. And to attach the tags, I used only female weevils, and then I starved them for 36 hours before release and glued the tags to their abdomens with super glue gel, and then painted the wires to identify individual weevils in the field. And there you can see the vacuum pump system I used to keep them in place while I was gluing the tags onto them. So I released them at dusk, and then each morning after that, I went back and found them again with the harmonic radar unit, marking the position with a flag every day. So there you can see an example of what I would get as a track. So every time I found a weevil, I measured the distance it had moved the night before, the bearing of its movement, its depth in the soil that I burrowed down into the soil during the day, and then the number of weevils that had actually arrived at the banana stem. So you can see there a picture of a weevil that made it to its host plant tissue. And then I did a separate experiment to evaluate if there was any effect of attaching the tag to the weevil on its movement. So this is a standard method used to evaluate the effect of tagging. I released 6 tagged and 6 untagged weevils at 1 meter from a piece of banana stem and then counted the number that arrived at the banana stem over 3 days, and did that with 4 replications. So you can see in the diagram now there are 12 weevils there, 6 have tags, 6 don't. And for the data analysis, to analyze the effects of the 2 main factors, those again are distance of release and presence or absence of banana stem tissue, and the blocks, on my response variables, the distance moved per night, the angle of movement, and then the depth of the weevil in the soil, I did a 3-way ANOVA. I also looked at the angle towards the center of those hexagonal arrays to see if it was different from 90 degrees. That is to tell whether the movement is random or oriented. So I did a t-test. And then for the number of weevils arriving at the stems at comparing 1 meter and 2 meters away, did a signed rank test. And for the double marking experiment, comparing tagged and untagged weevils, also a signed rank test. And here are my results. So there was a significant effect of the presence of banana stem tissue on the distance the weevils moved in a night. On the y-axis here, this is the distance the weevils moved in a night. And then here are my 4 treatments. 1 meter with no banana, 2 meters no banana, 1 meter with banana, 2 meters with banana. So the distance of release, 1 or 2 meters, did not affect the weevil movement, but the presence of banana did. They moved significantly farther in the presence of banana. The angle towards the center of the array, so this, I calculated this angle from the bearing data, whether or not there was a piece of banana in the middle, and compared them. So when banana was present, that angle was significantly smaller. These are the same treatments again. And then we also wanted to look at whether or not that movement was oriented. So that's seen if the means of the angles are significantly different from 90 degrees. So only at 1 meter away from the banana stem was movement actually oriented. So at 2 meters, the angle was smaller, but movement was not oriented, but at 1 meter it was. And then the presence of banana also had a significant effect on the depth the weevils burrowed in the soil. They burrowed significantly more shallowly when their host plant was present. So here's depth in soil, and again the same, banana and no banana. Also looking at the effect of release distance on the number of weevils arriving at the stem. So this is just comparing the plots that had a banana stem piece in the center. There was no significant difference between the numbers arriving at the stem at 1 meter and 2 meters away. And then in a separate double marking experiment, which is just to evaluate the effect of tagging, there was no difference between the number of weevils that arrived at the stem between untagged and tagged weevils. So we concluded there's no effect of attaching the tag to their movement. So to conclude, the banana weevils did move farther each night and burrowed less deeply in the soil when banana stem tissue was present. As far as the orientation of their movement, the angle towards the center of those hexagonal arrays was smaller when banana was present at both 1 and 2 meters away, but only at 1 meter was it actually oriented, not random. And then the distance of release did not affect the number of weevils arriving at the banana stem tissue. So we conclude that banana weevils can orient towards their host plant tissue under field conditions and also at a greater distance than previously observed. Previously, they were only found to orient in the lab up to 60 centimeters away. So this is orientation in the field at 1 meter away. And there's also a behavioral response at 2 meters where they move farther even though their movement isn't oriented. And also, this is the first time that harmonic grader has been used to study banana weevil movement, and as far as we know, in the tropics. So it's good to know that that is a useful method. And that's all. I'd like to acknowledge my funding source, NSF Iger, and all of these people who helped me out a lot. Thanks. I guess it coordinated well with my tagging schedule and was convenient. Yeah, they can live for a while without food, so there's not a danger of them starving to death. Yeah. In my experience, the range is pretty short when you're looking at things on the ground. People have used it to track things like Asian longhorn beetle in trees, and they can find it from maybe 50 meters away. I can only find the weevils from maybe 1 meter away. So bare ground where you don't have to search a very large space, it worked okay. If I had been searching in tangled vegetation over a large distance, it would have been a nightmare.
I have a question.
Yeah. Oh.
I was just wondering, have you thought of setting up more complex sort of scenarios with not just one banana, but maybe two, or have something else in there that could stimulate them, a water source or something? Have you thought of that?
The other thing I had thought of doing was having male weevils in the middle along with the banana plant, because they have an aggregation pheromone. But it turned out to be enough to just do this.
A concern to these regeneration efforts is the migration of worn root collar weevil from these mountain pine beetle kill stands out into the young regenerating cuplocks that they've established to regenerate the forest for future management purposes. Worn root collar weevil feeds on a variety of coniferous tree species, specifically lodgepole pine. Weevil feeding on mature trees does not significantly affect growth or result in high levels of mortality, but feeding on younger hosts has been observed to be a significant concern to growth. The worn root collar weevil adults lay eggs around the base of host trees. The eggs hatch, and the larvae feed on the root collar of the host tree during their 2 years of development. If the weevil feeding results in girdling of a host tree, translocation is upset, and the host tree is killed. Based on research conducted by Herb Sureski in Alberta and Staffan Lindgrind in British Columbia, we have three distribution explanations that help explain the patterns of worn root collar weevil-induced mortality within cuplocks. One is that worn root collar weevil populations are migrating from adjacent stands into the cuplock. Two, that worn root collar weevil populations are developing within slash left within these cut blocks after harvesting. And the third explanation is that both of these phenomena are happening in concert to produce these patterns of worn root collar weevil induced mortality we've observed. My research hopes to gain a better understanding of the movement of worn root collar weevil between dead unsalvaged stands and these live young regenerating stands. The research objective of the experiment that I'll be presenting today is to characterize the movement of worn root collar weevils between different habitat types. To accomplish this objective, we used a markery site experiment in an artificially constructed pine plantation that I will now explain in more detail. For the following experiments, we used a Bjorklund tree trunk funnel trap to collect all the weevils for the experiment, as well as to monitor weevil movement within these research plots. This simple trap, constructed out of tar paper and fluon, is attached to the base of young lodgepole pine trees and is able to effectively attract weevils as well as capture live worn root collar weevils. All the weevils for these experiments were labeled underneath a dissecting microscope using a high-speed rotary drill with a fine-pointed engraving bit to sand off precise labels onto the elytra of the insect. These labels were then colored using one of three stylish model paint colors, as you can see there. In the end, each weevil for the experiments received a unique marker from 0 to 99 in one of these three colors. Three plots were established, each 20 meters by 40 meters in size, containing 200 trees at 2 meter spacing. The live trees were young lodgepole pine seedlings about 1 meter in height. And these surrogate dead trees were collected from nearby mountain pine beetle kill trees. They were just cut off small branches, which were approximately the same size and height as the lodgepole pine seedlings. The first plot had 100 lodgepole pine seedlings planted at 2 meter spacing, surrounded by 100 surrogate dead trees. The second plot was the inverse of the first, with 100 surrogate dead trees surrounded by 100 live trees. The third plot had a mixed habitat in the middle, with 50 lodgepole pine seedlings and 50 surrogate dead trees at 2 meter spacing, surrounded by 100 surrogate dead trees. Each one of the trees was planted using the same technique, so for both the live and the dead trees, and they're both planted in similar habitat types. Each one of the surrogate dead trees and live lodgepole pine seedlings had a Bjorklund tree trunk funnel trap attached to the base of the tree to monitor weevil movement during these experiments. In each one of the three plots, we released approximately 100 Hylobius warreni along the center line of each one of the plots. Weevils that were captured during the experiments were identified for their unique marker, their specific location was noted, and they were then re-released at the base of the tree to continue the experiment. For the first 8 days of the experiment, we monitored daily capture, where we went out to each one of these three plots and checked all 600 traps for the presence of weevils. After the initial 8 days, we monitored captures 3 to 4 times a week for a total of 4 weeks. During the experiment, we were able to obtain 113 weevil captures. Also, of the 288 weevils that we released, we were able to recapture 101, giving us a recapture rate of 35%. The analysis was done with a logistic multivariate regression using backwards elimination to determine the effect of predictor variables on the probability of each individual tree capturing a weevil. These predictor variables were habitat type, so whether the tree was located within a live, dead, or mixed habitat, as well as tree status, so whether the tree was alive or dead, as well as other predictor variables such as distance from the release point, time since initial release, and distance from the margin. The final model we were left with for the probability of capturing a weevil on an individual tree included the predictor variables of distance from release point, time since initial release, as well as habitat type, so whether the tree was located within live, dead, or mixed habitat. This 3D mesh plot accurately summarizes the results from this model. The green sheet represents all the individual trees found within the live plot. The purple sheet represents all the trees found within the mixed habitat. And the red sheet represents all the trees found within the dead habitat. As you can notice, the probability of weevil capture was significantly higher on the live habitat than it was on the mixed dead habitats. Also, if you notice along the day axis, the probability of capturing a weevil was significantly higher at the beginning of the experiment than it was closer towards the end of the experiment. From this experiment, we conclude that these weevils tend to move towards habitats with live trees. Since they were observed to move more in the dead habitats, and they were observed to move less in the live habitats. Also, since the fact of whether the tree was alive or not did not significantly affect the probability of a tree capturing a weevil, and the habitat type did affect the probability of capturing a weevil, we conclude that habitat is the main factor affecting weevil migration. So this implies that these warren root collar weevils may be migrating from these mountain pine beetle killed stands into these young regenerating cut blocks. Future research will investigate Warren would call the weevil movement through these different buffer types so that we can develop better techniques to